Hello, my name's Craig Barker, and I'm the head of public engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. Welcome to Object Matters. This podcast explores the relationship between our guests and a museum collection item. And for this particular episode, I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. Kathleen Olive. Kathleen is a popular educator on Italian art, history, and culture, and presents on these subjects at the Italian Institute of Culture in Sydney, the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and across Australia as a national lecturer for the Australian Decorative and Fine Arts Society. For many years, she has led cultural tours to Italy, France, Spain, and Japan, and she's an honorary research fellow in the Department of Italian Studies here at the University of Sydney. Welcome, Kathleen. Thank you for joining us on Object Matters.
Thank you, Craig. Thanks for the invitation.
Now, before we start talking about the objects, could you begin talking a little bit about your own background and your own research interests? What drew you to Italy and to Italian art?
Well, surprisingly, when I was about 13, I had the goal of being an interior decorator, and I thought that I might go to Milan to study design. So I started learning Italian, and the career as an interior decorator, unfortunately, has not come to fruition. But instead, I pursued that interest and love of the Italian language. I followed it the whole way through my schooling, and then here at the University of Sydney, I went through to my PhD in Italian studies, and it was really a love of the language and of the literature that kept me engaged with Italy.
Mm. So how many times have you been to Italy? You've probably lost count.
I have lost count now because for more than 10 years, I was a very, very lucky person and I regularly took groups to Italy about six times a year before the pandemic. So I probably have lost count. But while I was studying here at the university, I was really fortunate to have my first trips to Italy and to Europe in general actually be supported by various scholarships here at the university. So my first exposures to Italy were absolutely as a result of my connection with the university.
Mm. At the risk of offending people from particular parts of Italy, but do you have, I mean, I think everyone has their favourite part of Italy to some degree, but which part of the country do you enjoy the most?
It's a very political question, but my study and my research, and so also therefore the kind of friendship groups that I've made, they always take me back to Florence in Tuscany, because that was where I did the bulk of my study and my research initially. But if I actually had to pick a favourite place in Italy that was not connected to work or study, it would be a toss-up between Sicily, which just represents the entire range of Mediterranean cultures in Italy. You know, Goethe said, if you go to Italy and you don't see Sicily, you haven't seen Italy at all. So I think I'd either go with Sicily or the other extreme, Venice, which is also, you know, not really very Italian, has its own identity in that sense. So probably, yes, those two places, Sicily or Venice.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, I guess, and both of them fit very nicely into your own research as well. You talked about Tuscany as well. Could you talk our listeners through a little bit about the areas you have researched and some of the work that you've done over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. My research has been mostly in the area of textual criticism, so working with texts, particularly in the 15th and 16th century in Tuscany, which is a period in which writers were beginning to use their local language or what we might call dialects to create great works of literature. And they really felt that it was appropriate to use Italian languages and not Latin as a grand literary language. And so I started working on those kind of texts and editing those texts for academic study. And I became really interested in texts that were kind of on the boundary, on the interface between not being really very proficient with Latin, not being particularly proficient or highfalutin with their Italian, but working in this hybrid kind of zone with what we might call artisan's language. So everyday practical literacy and how they could turn that into works of, you know, literary fancy. And that's what I've really enjoyed working on, is editing the texts of what we might call middle class or professional Tuscans in the 15th century.
What were they writing about? Were there particular themes that, or was it, you know, really anything and everything?
They really did write about anything and everything. The great thing about Italy in the Renaissance, which would be that period that we'd kind of look to describe from about the 13th century to about the 16th century, the great thing about that period is that Italy was a very, very literate place. You know, people were literate maybe three times more than the average literacy figures for places like England or France that we have at the same time. Yep. And that's really connected to, you know, Italian trade and banking and finance and that kind of world. So because the average Italian who had exercised a profession had to be literate for various civic reasons, they just write about everything. And the texts that I particularly have enjoyed working on are what we call commonplace books. So they're a pastiche, which is relevant actually for what we're talking about today in terms of our object from the collection. But they're pastiche texts where writers are drawing or translating from existing collections of works, but piecing them together to create their own personal narrative. Mm. So scrapbooking in some kind of a way.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. But I mean, in a sense, it's sort of an evolution of a Greek and Roman tradition too, of the core myths or the core stories remained, but each author would tinker and bring a slightly different perspective to
it. Yeah, you draw on all those commonplaces.
Oh, interesting. So let's bring you from Italy back to Sydney now, and of course you've had a working relationship of sorts with the Chowchak Wing Museum, and previous to that with the Nicholson Museum. How have you worked with the collection, and how have you worked with the museum team over the years?
I've been very lucky, I think, to work with you all on addressing your public, so addressing people who are interested in the museum, in the collection of the museum and the objects within it. And in the public talks that I've done for the museum, I've always been quite interested in how we can revisit some of the sites associated with the objects in the collection and experience them today in order to understand the historical and cultural trajectory of those places. And I've also been really lucky, I think, to work with people like yourself and the wonderful Candace Richards on tours, private tours of the, particularly the new museum and of its fabulous exhibitions and permanent collection.
Now, what object have you chosen from the collection of the Chowchak Wing Museum?
Well,
460,000 to choose from. Obviously, I'm assuming something with an Italian theme, but
correct. I have to say, actually, when you asked me to think of something, I thought immediately of this object. I have chosen for us, he has many, many names, but let's call him the boy with a thorn, or the Spinario, if we want to give him his kind of received international name. And he is a lovely sculpture that entered the collection in the middle of the 20th century.
Yes, yes. He appears in Arfordale Trendall's little catalogue that was produced in the early 1940s of the cast collection. So he's been with us since at least then. I think for our listeners who have not had an opportunity to see this particular one, although they may have seen the statue in other forms, we'll get to that in a moment without even necessarily realising it, could you describe the Chowchak Wing Museum example?
This is just a test of my skills in ekphrasis, isn't it? Am I able to summon for listeners
audio descriptive tools?
Yes, the object in question. Well, we're talking about an object that's not particularly large, so it's less than 1 meter high, so it's not life size. It's semi-life size sculpture in bronze of a boy. It's a naked boy who's sitting on a tree stump, and he has drawn his left leg up to cross it over his right knee as he sits down, and he is bent over in complete absorption as he studies his left foot quite closely. So he's got this line that draws up through the left side of his body, through his knee and his shoulder, and then the right side of his body is crouching down to examine his left foot in close detail. And he's on the cusp of adolescence, really. So he's a pubescent boy sitting on his stump looking at his foot.
He's very, very focused, isn't he?
Extremely focused. I think that's one of the things that's so fascinating about this sculpture, is that it's someone caught in a really everyday, recognizable to anyone who grew up in Australia and ran over the lawn in the middle
the
of summer. Exactly. It's boy extracting a bindi, really is everything we need to know about him. But it's such an intensely quotidian moment that he is completely concentrated upon, and yet the beauty of the piece transcends that everyday experience of pulling a bindi out of your foot.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting subject matter. We'll talk about its long history in a moment, but for a sculptor to actually think of it, it's a really interesting perspective, and obviously it fits into the broader idea of bending the human form and creating new shapes out of something we know so well. But you are right. It's very mundane, and yet at the same time, quite exquisitely beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, it's in that tradition of particularly Hellenistic sculpture, taking the mundane and investing it with an idealized beauty that's just sublime. But this sculpture, when it reemerges, which we'll talk about, of the group of sculptures that it reemerges with in the Renaissance that so fascinate Italian artists, this is definitely the one that most focuses on that mundane, everyday kind of situation. The others are quite grand or dramatic or historically significant. This one definitely was unique in that private kind of interior moment that it reflects.
So obviously our example of it is a 20th century cast copy, but can you take us through the long, long, long history of the boy with the fawn and its many, many variations?
Yeah, happily. I mean, I'm really pleased that we're going to talk about the modern history of this piece and specifically the history of the piece in the collection, because that's so fascinating. But the history of this piece takes us back, well, almost 2,500 years, really. It's quite a contested piece in terms of its original history. So our object is a copy of a bronze sculpture that is in the Capitoline Museums in Rome. And the Capitoline Museums in Rome, well, they're just a fascinating museum in their own right. They're sometimes described as the first modern museum in Italy. They were opened in 1471 by the Pope, who granted to the people of Rome, so they're a public museum in that sense, a core collection of bronze statues that he was really concerned to preserve. And this was one of them. So it's one of the first. Our object is a copy of one of the first objects to enter the Capitoline Museum. And that piece in the Capitoline, of which our artifact is a copy, a direct copy, in fact, its history is now thought to have emerged sometime in the 5th century BCE, with one part of the sculpture, the head. The body is thought to have been made in the 3rd century BCE. And then what we seem to be looking at is a pastiche, so a collection, those objects being brought together, fused together in the 1st century BCE to respond to the tastes of that particular moment in time. And the great thing about the object in the Capitoline, of which our artifact is a copy, is that that group of statues that it comprised a part of, a number of them have since been discovered to be these kind of pastiche objects. You know, the very, very famous example would be the medieval pastiche that is the Capitoline wolf with Romulus and Remus, probably cast in the 15th century by a Renaissance sculptor. So the original object is itself a pastiche, and it's not a unique example either. So there are a number of copies of this work in marble, slightly smaller, slightly larger, different foot being rested on a different knee. And those are spread throughout museums from Russia to England. So this is, it's a sculpture that was obviously considered to be quite interesting and was copied a number of times.
Yeah, well, fitting into that broader trend. Well, it's kind of two things going on here, isn't there? One is that broader trend of, particularly within the Roman world, of copying Greek original bronzes, but often in other material, particularly marble, once marble quarries became far more open and far more affordable as a material. So if you couldn't afford the highfalutin bronze original, you could always get a copy carved in marble. So hence the spread of the image. But also really interesting, your discussion about the pastiche, because again, many people aren't aware that Greek bronze statues were actually made in bits and then welded together. You know? So this idea of it actually being done over a longer period of time, it's not something we normally tend to think of, is it? It's normally tend to think that it's the same foundry, the same workshop doing it all at once. And I find that a truly remarkable achievement of, you know, we'll take that head and we'll take that torso and voila, it works.
Yes, it does work. Absolutely, it works. And I think one of the great things about this is that when we now think about classical bronze sculpture, in some ways we see it through the lens of the Renaissance, in which, in fact, sculptures like this became of great interest to Italian sculptors living in the 15th and 16th century and their patrons. And they were obsessed with the idea that pieces like this had been cast in one go.
Yes.
And
they
were obsessed with trying to work out how they could do that themselves. And there's a little irony for them, I think, in the fact that so many of the objects they were studying actually actually weren't cast in one piece at all, but they really set themselves the challenge of learning how to do that. And some of those techniques are spontaneously, it would seem, recreated, reinvented in the 15th century without direct knowledge of how they were done.
Yes, yeah.
For example, in Greece, where some objects were cast entirely in one go. So, yeah, it's a really interesting kind of technical history for a piece like this.
Yeah. So, I mean, how are Italian artists responding to it, and why do they keep on coming back to it? I mean, you talk about that broader Renaissance engagement and love for the classical human form as well, and particularly after, you know, all of those centuries where the human body is not being depicted, then suddenly there's the freedom to do so. But, you know, it's got a lifespan beyond the Renaissance as well. What is it about this particular piece that drew them?
I think one of the great things about this piece is that the object that our object in the museum is a copy of, that object didn't ever really drop out of view. So we have this idea, I think, that the Renaissance, you know, the word itself means rebirth, that it has to happen because the classical world had somehow dropped out of view or been suppressed during that, you know, dark, tumultuous period of the Dark Ages. And in fact, there's a whole collection of sculptures, particularly sculptures that never drop out of view. Many, of course, are melted down and the bronze is reused because it's too valuable a resource. But there's a core collection of bronze sculptures in Rome, of which this is one, that are from our earliest records displayed outside the Lateran Palace, which was the residence of the Bishop of Rome, who, you know, we would call the Pope. So this sculpture was exhibited outside the Lateran Palace in Rome. We know in the 12th century we've got these fabulous descriptions of it by travellers who mistake it for various things. You know, one person even suggests Priapus, which is a kind of hilarious interpretation of a young boy who is not particularly priapic in his body at all. So it doesn't drop out of view, and it begins to be studied, described, but then also studied. So a key moment for the Renaissance in terms of this sculpture seems to be when two Florentine artists lose out on a really important job that they're hoping to get in Florence. And in a bit of a huff, they take themselves down to Rome for a busman's holiday, and they study all the examples of classical architecture and art that they can find in Rome. And they seem to really intently look at this work. And those two artists are really key artists for formulating this revival of classical ideals in art. They are Brunelleschi, who kind of single-handedly masterminds the construction of the enormous freestanding dome on Florence Cathedral after he comes back from his huff in Rome. His great friend is Donatello, who single-handedly revives the idea that you can show a male nude in a beautiful, even heroic form without this being somehow morally suspect.
Yeah.
And so those two definitely seem to look at this sculpture. Brunelleschi 100% does, because he copies it in a smaller form work, sculptural
relief.
He has him clothed, which is interesting.
Yeah.
He has a relief that he makes of the sacrifice of Isaac, this Jewish story of Abraham's ready to sacrifice, willing to sacrifice his only son. And in that scene, there's a figure kind of tucked off in the corner examining his foot next to a donkey, who is our Spinario. Mm. And then he just recurs again and again. He shows up in one of the most important kind of revolutionary moments for Italian painting, which is the frescoes by Masaccio in the Brancacci Chapel in Florence. He, you know, we always forget to look at the walls in the Sistine Chapel because we're so taken by Michelangelo's ceiling, but the walls of the Sistine are painted by the best artists of the Renaissance, and Perugino in his work there has a Spinario examining his foot before he's about to be baptized by John the Baptist.
Sure,
so he just recurs again and again, and a copy in marble even finds its way to Florence.
Funny, being ingrained so blatantly into Christian iconography as well, in a way that looking at the statue, I wouldn't see a way of fitting, but is it just the artist loving the work so much that they want to find a way to work it in, perhaps? Or
I think that's a big part of it, but that impulse to take potentially suspect elements and Christianize them so you can hold on to them, it's really, really really strong. So the earliest description we have of our object from the 12th century is by a rabbi traveling through Italy on his way to Jerusalem. And he describes this as perhaps being Absalom, the beloved son of King David, beautiful son of King David, who is in some senses he meets his fate because of his great beauty. You know, he's hanged from a tree by his own beautiful hair, much to David's sorrow. And he identifies this as being a sculpture of Absalom, David's beautiful son. So I think there's something that people are responding to in the beauty, and they see that beauty as a manifestation of their own ideology, whether that's Jewish or Christian or pagan. There's a way that you can make sense of it, or entirely erotic. You know, we haven't talked about the potential erotic dimensions of a sculpture like this either. So I think all of those things, the reason this is a transcendent work of art is because it has all of those aspects in it.
You're listening to Object Matters. My guest for this episode is Dr. Kathleen Olive. Getting from the Renaissance to the modern world, you talk about from Rome to Florence, and then obviously a much broader global expansion as we head into early modern Europe and into modern times. Where are some of the places that we see examples? He's everywhere, I guess.
He's everywhere, Craig. He's at the Pushkin Museum in St. Petersburg. That appears to be a Roman bronze copy of the original. Original, I'm using the word original our capital line piece, but I'm using scare quotes around it. He shows up in the British Museum. There's a great copy in marble that ends up in Lorenzo the Magnificent of the Medici family's collection in Florence. They had Lorenzo had a sculpture garden that was open for study to people like Michelangelo, so really formed a Renaissance artist's idea about what good sculpture should look like. So that piece is now in the Uffizi collection in Florence, in that important museum there. And then there's just this explosion in the 18th and 19th century of copies in other media, so particularly copies in media that can be used for teaching or for study, or that can be more easily transported, obviously. So Napoleon gets a copy of it, for example.
Right. And this is fitting into the broader grand tourist, the world of the young, recently graduated intellectuals of Northern Europe travelling through Italy, supposedly to engage with art and culture, but getting up to all sorts of mischief as well, neglected from the, the official history of the grand tours. But so I guess that sense of transformation as well, that you're suddenly seeing copies made everywhere. Our copy, of course, is early 20th century. Do you know more about the modern process of copying?
I mean, aspects of it are really quite disturbing, I suspect, to modern curators. At the end of the 19th century, Italy changes, it transforms from being a collection of separate kingdoms and duchies and city-states or territories ruled by foreign powers like the French or the Spanish, and it transforms through a movement called the Risorgimento into a united, federated, unified country. And that process, which is more or less complete by the end of the 19th century, also leads to the creation of a network of state museums. So for the first time, these smaller little private collections or semi-public collections like the Capitoline, where our original piece resides, they become part of a state network. And the state decides that, you know, partly in order to increase Italy's reputation as a modern unified nation abroad, so by sending diplomatic gifts that are copies of key works in the Italian peninsula abroad, or to allow study, particularly in an academic tradition, so sitting in a room and really studying an object closely as an artist in order to learn from it in your own technique and approach. It licenses modern companies to make reproductions of key objects in the collections of these state museums. And there are two modern foundries in Naples that are given the license to make copies of objects in the extraordinary archaeological museum in Naples, but also further abroad, including the Capitoline museums in Rome. And those two companies are known for the names of the family firms. There's the De Angelis family firm and the Curazzi family firm.
Yes. And of course, I mean, both of them, but Curazzi in particular, I mean, so many of the statues from the Villa of the Papyrus that have been excavated from the 1750s and 1760s, for example, that likewise, you're suddenly seeing them pop up all across Europe because they're commercially available or freely available.
Yeah, yeah. Well, commercial, I mean, they're so expensive. So Andrew Carnegie, for example, the American industrialist turned philanthropist, he commissions a whole set of copies of Roman statues that are in the Archaeological Museum in Naples, where each individual bronze copy cost him roughly three times what it would have cost him to buy a new Model T Ford. I mean,
wow,
they're incredibly expensive. And the ones that were ready-made that they had in their collection, these two foundries who unite for a period of about 5 years in 1910 to 1915.
Really?
Yeah. The two companies come together. They're known as the Fonderie Artistiche Riunite, the reunited conjoined artistic foundries, and that's when our object in the museum is made.
Right.
So it must have been made in that 5 year
period.
Yeah, because they come together and then they demerge, so they merge and then they demerge again.
Yeah.
And when these are being commissioned from these two foundries or that united foundry briefly, if they've got it in stock, they can actually deliver it to you in America, in England, I suspect not Australia, in a 15-day period. They can actually consign it to you if they have to go to the museum and make the cast in a really complicated process, a direct cast from the original object, then it might take up to 60 to 90 days to get your statue in bronze consigned. But it's this extraordinary commercial enterprise.
Amazon.
It is. It is. It's the Amazon of, you know, bronze reproductions.
But, I mean, my understanding, too, was that you could purchase them with the surface affected to make it look like either aged or newer bronze as well. So there were all sorts of tricks that they had to apply to the surface. Is that the case?
Yeah, it is. So fabulously, I think we would describe the piece in the museum's collection. That seems to have been ordered by whomever ordered it, and we don't know who that is, alas. But whoever ordered it seems to have requested what was known as the Pompeii finish, which is the verdigris. We didn't say in our description of our object, but it does have that green verdigris finish.
Yes.
And that was one finish that could be requested at the time of the order. You could also order your object in Herculaneum, which was a kind of a browner finish. And you could also, and I think this is really telling, you could order a Renaissance or modern finish, which was a glossy kind of black finish.
Right.
And so when you find things at the Carnegie, at the Getty Center in Malibu, you find all of these different finishes that were requested by the purchaser at the time of making the order.
Yeah. Fascinating. The company itself, did it survive long into the 20th century? Or the companies, I should say.
So they merge briefly in the 19-teens and then they demerge again. And the one that does continue, and it still continues in some form today, is Curazzi, who are quite well known, as you said, for their reproductions, which are found in museum collections throughout the world for teaching purposes, for conservation purposes, for various kind of reasons. But also, it must be said, just found in gardens as decoration.
Yep.
So this one, with its verdigris finish in the museum's collection, was probably intended for outdoor display because that Pompeii finish in green was preferred for outdoor objects.
Okay.
So and as you alluded to earlier, you know, this isn't our only Spinario in Sydney. Mm, the museum has one, but there's also one, as you pointed out to me, which I'd kind of completely forgotten. We've got one in marble in the Botanic Gardens in Sydney as well.
Now, in the museum's collection, there's a photograph from Charles Kerry and Company, so it's dated to about somewhere between the 1890s to 1915s when Kerry and Co. were operational, but a still life, I guess is the best way of describing it, of the piece within the Royal Botanic Gardens in Sydney, where it still is, with its title of Boy Extracting Fawn, but of course this is a marble one, isn't it?
And made earlier than our piece in the collection as well. So the marble copy in the Botanic Gardens is part of a job lot that's ordered in a really similar way in the 1880s, a job lot of classical sculpture to adorn your outdoor space in your growing modern city. And I think what's really interesting is that the Renaissance artists that I spoke about, they were looking at our Spinario to find something that reflected their own modern moment as they consciously thought of themselves, they consciously described themselves as modern. And it's really interesting to think about job lot orders of classical sculptures making their way to Sydney to represent something about how Sydney wanted to think of itself at that moment.
Well, I mean, that very Victorian, but 19th century more generally, attitude towards the classical past that you see within Europe, and of course being reflected in the Australian experience for the process of colonisation. So, of course, the colony of New South Wales wanting to present itself as part of the British Empire, therefore the inheritors of the great Roman Empire, ergo we must have Roman statues. Seems very convoluted from a 21st century perspective, but made absolute sense at the time.
It's an interesting choice, isn't it, about what kind of civilization do you want to say that you come from and that you identify with. So whoever has ordered this job lot for the Botanic Gardens in Sydney is conscious of the importance of the ancient past, but is not conscious of the importance of the ancient past in the country that they actually find themselves in. So, you know, we talk quite openly, I think, now about the socio-political questions behind some modern statuary in colonial places like Australia. But this is part of that same kind of discourse, but we have to push a little deeper to get at it because we're not looking at a statue of a colonizer or a so-called explorer. We're looking at a boy pulling a thorn out of his foot, but he's still saying he's still connected somehow to how we think of ourselves, what our imperial ambitions are, as you've said.
Are you aware of other examples in Australia of the statue?
Not of the Spinario, no, but he is an example of what you encounter across Australia. You know, on my way here to meet with you today, I walked through a very beautiful courtyard on campus that connects the pharmacy building to the main quadrangle, where you'll find a copy of Gian Bologna's Mercury statue surrounded by, at the moment, camellias in bloom and a lovely Japanese maple turning colour. If you go to Sydney Hospital on Macquarie Street, you'll find a Florentine wild boar that is a copy of a statue in Italy. So even these copies of Renaissance sculptures are still a way of establishing a continuity with the ancient past.
Yes, and very much rooting the Australian experience within the European one
within
the mindset of the 19th century, isn't it?
Yeah.
How have you worked with this particular piece over the years, both in terms of our example in Sydney, but also, I mean, obviously you've come across it in your tours. How do you find yourself engaging with it? And you know, if you're leading a tour group, how do you work it into the broader experience of learning about art and culture while travels in Italy?
One of the things I think is great about this sculpture, and which is something that traveling to a place gives you, or it must be said, a culture of making reproductions like the one in the museum's collection also permits, that is an understanding of sculpture in the round. So we're quite used, I think, when we're looking at books, for example, and when we're watching things on a screen, to seeing things frontally or at the most from the side.
Yes.
But the thing about this boy, and the thing that really captured the imagination of artists from the 16th century in particular onwards, is that we see him in the round. He's designed to be seen from all sides.
Yes.
He's very beautiful
from
all sides. He has his weight shifted in a sculptural technique that we would describe as counterpose or contrapposto from the Italian. And that is the idea that he is carefully calculated mechanically as a sculpture, but also as a human body, to have certain parts of his body adjusting to balance weight in other parts of his body. And that means that when you see him from behind, his back, his spine, his shoulders, his buttocks, they're all adjusting for the pose that he's shown in.
Yeah.
And so the thing I think that I love about interacting with this piece, and I've primarily, it must be said, interacted with the Capitoline copy, which is displayed in the round. You are able to walk around it as you are all of the other pieces from that Lateran palace collection that formed the nucleus of the Capitoline statuary collection, is interacting with him in the round, encouraging people to walk around statues in the round and get a sense of how, in the 16th century in particular, Italian sculptors are really struck by classical works like this in the round. They move away from a tradition of a statue just being something that you affix to a wall. You don't have to worry about the back. You don't even give it a back.
Yeah,
you just stick it onto the facade of a church, and they become much more interested. You know, the classic example would be something like Michelangelo's David, in how to conceive of that object being something that the viewer experiences from all possible sides.
Yeah.
It has to be beautiful no matter how you look at it. From where you look at it, it has to be beautiful.
Yeah. What meaning does this particular sculpture have for you personally?
I think for me personally, the thing that I really respond to in this work is how we consciously choose and respond to objects from the past and find a way to have them make meaning in our current context. And sometimes, as we've said, sometimes that can be a deliberate political choice. I think often it's a very unconscious but still political choice. And it's the way in which those objects can be co-opted to take on an extra layer of meaning. So I guess stratigraphies of meaning are something that I always really respond to. And I really appreciate that in this object, that there are many lenses by which you can read it.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's, you know, Greek, Roman, Renaissance, modern.
Australian.
Imperial. Art.
Decoration. You
know, decoration, interior design.
Conservation.
Yes.
Study.
And also the melting of high art with commercial entities and the fact that the Carnegies and someone wanted to have a copy as well.
And artistic training in between. Seurat writes in Paris in the modern era that one of his favourite poses that life models would strike in art classes was the pose of the Spinario. So, you know, some person is being asked even to sit in this pose for artists to draw him.
Most comfortable pose to sit as a life model, but...
Hold this pose for 2 hours. Thank you.
How do you find yourself responding each time you see it, both the Sydney example, but also the quote-unquote original when you're in Rome?
I think I particularly respond to the body itself and to the careful depiction of a body that is in a kind of coiled moment. He is ready to move but isn't yet really moving. He's still but also full of life at the same time. So I think it's his body that his pose, I really respond to it.
Yeah, you're right. You can see an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old boy who's stopped temporarily but is otherwise running and is literally, once that pesky fawn is out of the way, he's going to be running again. It's so lively and yet a moment of silence.
Tradition gave him quite a status as well. I mean, we haven't said this, but we look at him as a boy pulling a thorn out of his foot. But in the 15th century, there's a whole story that is fabricated around him, has a lot of echoes of Marathon, that he is a boy who ran from a town near Viterbo to the north of Rome to alert the Romans to the possible invasion by Etruscans, and that he, on the way, lodged a thorn in his foot, but was so dedicated to his mission that he didn't pull the thorn out until he'd delivered the message that he had. So, I mean, in that sense, he's also someone, I suppose, if we go along with that modern story that's given to him, we also need to see him as someone who's in a moment of great repose after exertion as well. Yeah. So all the muscles ready and engaged, but also finally in a moment of relaxation as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, Kathleen, the question I ask everyone who appears on the podcast, and I have warned you about this, but I ask everyone to choose one word, any one word, English, Italian, if you want to. In what word does this particular statue signify to you?
Well, I'm going to cheat by telling you all of the one words that I weighed up using. So I thought about the word torsion, which refers to a kind of a coiled energy within artworks that is symmetrically distributed but constantly moving, like a coil or a corkscrew staircase. So I thought about torsion and I thought it was a little too obtuse. I thought about elegance. I thought about balance. And in the end, I just settled on the word absorption because I think he is so absorbed in this kind of self-concentration of the moment, but absorption is how I respond to it as well. I'm really absorbed by it when I look at it.
You're right. You can't help but not look at it, can't you? And in a gallery full of objects all demanding attention, that's a real credit to the creator of the work as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. Whoever they were.
Finally, what would you like our listeners to think about when they actually get the chance to see either this or those lucky ones who get to go to Italy and see the original and the Capitoline?
Well, I think I'd take that word absorption, and I would encourage people, when they're in the museum, whether they're in front of an object such as this one or something else, particularly perhaps objects that are really less familiar to you, more challenging in terms of what you're used to looking at, is to give yourself the time to be absorbed. You know, we hurry through museums. The average person spends less than 2 minutes in front of an artwork in the average art gallery around the world. So I guess I would take that word absorption and say, look closely and think about what aspects of the object catch your interest. Think about whether those are conscious choices of the maker or if they're accidents over time, you know, something that's been dropped and broken and put back together. Just allow yourself to be absorbed by the object, do a really close personal analysis of it. And when you leave the museum, it's probably going to be that object that you gave the time to that will stay with you and resonate.
That is an excellent place to wrap up this episode. Thank you, Kathleen. Dr. Kathleen Olive, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Craig.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chowchak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney wishes to pay our respect to the traditional custodians of the lands in which we record this podcast.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chowchak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, Muse Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.